Howdy, folks. This is Jimmy Akin, and I wanted to let you know about a special offer. When you become a patron of the Cordial Catholic Podcast at $8 or more a month, Keith will send you a copy of my new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. To become a patron, just go to patreon.com/cordialcatholic.
Hi. Hey, welcome to the Cordial Catholic. This is a podcast for non-Catholics, new Catholics, and those looking to dig deeper into the Catholic faith. I'm K. Albert Little. I'm an evangelical, non-denominational convert to Catholicism. And this podcast is born out of one singular idea. To fill in the gaps between what you think you know about Catholics and what Catholics actually believe. In my experience, as I was journeying into the church and asking questions about what Catholics believed in, I found out that what I thought I knew was often completely backwards. We're filling in gaps here, having real Catholic conversations with real Catholic thinkers from the heart of the Catholic Church. No misinformation here. And my guest this week is a fantastic one. I'm joined by Dr. Moira McQueen, the Executive Director of the Canadian Catholic Bioethics Institute at the University of Toronto. We tackle a whole range of Catholic bioethical ideas, from abortion to euthanasia to gender issues, from life until death, all the Catholic questions about all the different Catholic stages of life. It's a phenomenal interview, and I guarantee you, whether you are a non-Catholic Christian wondering what the Catholic Church believes about these issues and why they believe it, or if you are a Catholic who's been Catholic for a long time, I guarantee you'll learn something new from this interview. Dr. McQueen works at the absolute heart of these issues and knows what she's talking about really well. Hey, do you guys know about Oberammergau? This is the tiny German city where in 1634, after the bubonic plague passed them by, they made a vow to perform a passion play depicting the life and death of Jesus every 10 years as a form of celebration, a form of thanksgiving. Well, 2020 is an Oberammergau Passion Play year, and Select International Tours and Cruises, a sponsor of this show, wants to get you there. They offer a number of pilgrimages, tours, and cruises that will end you up in Oberammergau one way or another. The Passion Play sounds fantastic. Look it up on YouTube if you're curious. Just type in Oberammergau. It should spell check that for you. And check out the amazing transformation this city undergoes. 2,000 people from the town are involved, and pilgrims from all over the world stream to Oberammergau to witness this passion play. Go to selectinternationaltours.com/cordial for more information on how you can get there and to see the various options. And hey, while you're there, sign up for an email reminder if any of the cruises or tours that you are interested in have an update or new offerings. They won't sell your email address, they won't spam you, but they will give you updates on any of the tours you express an interest in. It's selectinternationaltours.com/cordial. By supporting them, you support this podcast, so check them out, please. And thank you to Select International Tours and Cruises for their continuing support. I'm very grateful. And thank you, friends, for your support as well. Go to patreon.com/cordialcatholic if you want to give even $1 a month to help keep this show sustainable and keep things moving forward. Guys, I really appreciate all of your support, and I could not do it without you. If you want to give $8 or more a month as a thank you, I can send you a copy of Jimmy Akin's new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. But hey, even $1 or $2 a month goes a long, long way. And I appreciate those who are already giving so much. Thank you, guys. And thanks, everyone, for listening and for praying and for fasting for this show. Guys, it's a dream, and I'm so grateful. So thank you. Big time. With no further ado, here's my fantastic interview with Dr. Moira McQueen. Hello, friends. Welcome back to the Cordial Catholic. This week, I am absolutely thrilled to be joined by Dr. Moira McQueen. Dr. McQueen is the executive director of the Canadian Catholic Bioethics Institute. She received a law degree from the University of Glasgow. She has a Master's of Divinity and a PhD in Moral Theology from St. Michael's College at the University of Toronto, where since 1994, she's taught in the Faculty of Theology. In September 2014, she was appointed by Pope Francis to a 5-year term on the International Theological Commission, a 30-member Vatican advisory body within the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. Fantastic. I'm so thrilled to have her on the show. Dr. McQueen, thank you for being here. Thank you so much, and hello.
Hello, I'm very thrilled to be here too.
Well, I'm glad. Thank you so much for agreeing to be here. Listen, I want to start off right away, if we can, and I want to begin on the ground floor. Because, you know, I am a non-denominational evangelical convert to Catholicism. And for me, one of the most attractive things about the Catholic faith was this coherent worldview. As a non-Catholic Christian, my theology was kind of a patchwork quilt, I guess I would say. We would read our Bibles and interpret the scriptures within our own particular faith tradition, or sometimes community, or sometimes even just group of friends, or even by ourselves sometimes. You know, we'd read theologians who'd try to help us make sense of things, but ultimately there was no coherence to it. It was centered around the Bible, we'd say, but the Bible has to be interpreted. And it was a million different ways. So when I was looking at the Catholic Church, it seemed like a much more comprehensive worldview that kind of covered everything from abortion and contraception to euthanasia and assisted suicide and even marriage and divorce and gender identity. Can you speak to this comprehensive framework that kind of underpins how the Catholic Church understands these issues of life and death and all these decisions in between?
Yes, I'll try. I like your word comprehensive because I think that sums it up pretty well. I think it's partly because in the Catholic tradition, we're obviously not just talking about scripture, although scripture is fundamental. But in Catholic moral teaching, then we're looking at two platforms, if you like. So we're looking at scripture and what's called tradition. And so scripture is incredibly important. I mean, the word of Jesus Christ is what we're basing our faith on. The Catholic tradition has also looked very much to where our reason comes in. And I know that can be a little bit of a problem with other Christian denominations. But the Catholic tradition has always had a very positive account of reason. And so what that is really saying is that, dominated by the word, we're given this God-given reason to work out in the world by observation, by experience, by this capacity to reason, which only human beings have, to see what is right and what is wrong. And so an exponent of the Catholic faith like St. Thomas Aquinas would be very important in this regard, because not only did he follow Aristotle and therefore brought in all the philosophical worldviews, all that critical thinking that wise people had done over the centuries, but he linked it with theology. And so he paid a lot of attention to this God-given reason, saying this is what we have our reason for. And he did a lot of work in what we would nowadays maybe call Christian anthropology, talking about the nature of the human person. And part of our nature is our reason. So then this idea that we have to use that reason, we do use it to work things out. He also was a wonderful exponent of the importance of conscience in every individual, and talking about the dignity of conscience, talking to a certain extent about the freedom of conscience, meaning by that, that all of us have the capacity again to work things out, to look at the world, to work out what's right and what's wrong. He went a little bit further than that. He talked about our conscience being in us as a gift of God, again. again, like our reason, everything is derived from God. But this conscience, he said, you know, even small children have an innate sense of what's right and what's wrong, what's fair, what's unfair. Kids say it all the time. It's not fair, that kind of thing. Because there's we can see just by how people are treated in the world, maybe how we are treated, maybe how we treat other people, but we have this sense of justice that's all linked in with this idea of conscience. And I think what that means is, in that Catholic comprehensive worldview, is that we're certainly looking to the magisterial teachings, so the teachings of the Pope and the bishops, the leaders in the church. We look to them for guidance, and we look to them for examples of maybe how we should behave, what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. But at the same time, with our own God-given conscience, we have to deal with that. We in a sense navigate that. We pay a lot of attention to that. Their teachings, the same way we pay a lot of attention to Scripture. And with our conscience and our reason, for many of us, we begin to sort of see, yes, that is right. That is right. Not because the church says so, but because we can see that it's right, or we can see that it's wrong. I would just use something as basic as something like adultery as an example. You could say it's scripturally based, but in the real world, in the everyday world, I think there are very few people who would ever say adultery is all right. There's harm caused, and that would be the Catholic, if you like, definition of when we can say something is right and something is wrong. There has to be some kind of harm before you can really say something is wrong. And in many cases, we can see that. And I know we don't always agree with other denominations, even other faiths, and with people who have no faith, about some of the conclusions about what's right and what's wrong. But there's many areas where we do agree, and it comes back again to your word, that comprehensive worldview. So the Catholic Church talks about natural law, and by that they mean not, you know, the waves, and you can tell when the tides are, and all those amazing things that you can work out metrically. But it really means the kind of the human nature, the attention that we pay to human nature, which in some respects never changes. You know, all humans are born with this capacity for thinking, unless there's a problem, of course. But on the whole, that's one of the great gifts. We develop, we grow in appreciation, we can work out what's right and wrong, our conscience comes into play. And we're very much free agents at that level, in terms of the importance of conscience, that we have to work out what we think is right and wrong, given all the guidance that we have. But the ultimate responsibility comes back to me. So it's very, there's a kind of a lot of respect paid to, I'll use the modern word, autonomy. Free will is actually a better, you know, indication of what that really means. And so while we have all the attention we pay to Scripture and all the attention we pay to church teaching, the church itself, the Catholic Church itself, recognizes the importance of that conscience for all of us. So I think there's a constant interaction. It's not a case of obeying because the church says so. But I think it's, as mature Christians, or Christians who really are seeking the truth, or looking for explanations, etc., then we begin to see the wisdom in these teachings, and the wisdom in Scripture, of course, because I think they interact rather than being two totally separate spheres. And the two together, I think, help to give perhaps a more comprehensive or extensive viewpoint than you would in church that is more sola scriptura, the older approach where you really paid more attention to Scripture, and if your ethics weren't really covered in Scripture, well, it would take some time to work that out. I don't want to be too, generic about that, because it's not really entirely the way it is. But for a while, it looked as if that's what it was. There was a distrust of natural law on one side, and paying attention only to Scripture on the other, whereas the Catholic Church, you know, in its own wisdom, has always kept the two in tension. And so the two are equally important, if you like. Yeah. So I think that's what helps that comprehensive viewpoint, which is maybe harder to find in some other approaches.
Yeah, I think you've given such a fantastic and thorough explanation there of what's working. And I have so many things I'm thinking about as you say those things. And one of those is this, yes, I think what was lacking in my faith tradition was we only had maybe one arm of this two-armed animal. We only had the Bible. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that is obviously very valued, as you said, in the Catholic Church. Sure. But then you must interpret that in some kind of lens. And I mean, in your answer here, you've drawn in natural law, you've drawn in the autonomy of a person, you've drawn in ancient theologians like Thomas Aquinas. Yes. And this is the value, you know, of the Catholic worldview, of bringing in all those things to help. And then we have the magisterium, where we as Catholics are told we can trust this body to help us to understand how to live. Right.
Yeah. Right, very, very much so. And so, and in the Catholic Church, we do acknowledge that magisterium, so the teaching of the popes and bishops as the sort of highest level. And so if I'm teaching theology, then that's what I'm using. You know, I'm using their teaching. I'm using everything that they say. I think it's important to say, too, that that is a developing teaching as well. And so, because different situations come up all the time, so there are some areas where there's not much change. But in the area of bioethics that I would be more involved in on a day-to-day basis, something new is always coming along that the church then has to evaluate on the moral level to see, does this help human flourishing or does it hinder? And they take their time over that. This is the interesting side to me too, you know, I mean, so we have revelation on the one side, but we have this ongoing need for reasoning through things and working from principles to see what's really of value to the human. So, for example, when they started doing in vitro fertilization, it was about 6 or 7 years before the Catholic Church came up with an actual document to deal with the moral principles involved. And that made sense to me. It makes sense to most people. It's a new situation. It has to be evaluated. You have to work out all the different factors in it. Is there harm? Is there benefit? As you would in any moral decision. But we always have these first principles which always revolve around the dignity of the human person. And that dignity, as you know, is always talked about from conception until natural death. And the idea that a person must never be treated as a means to an end, but always of value in himself or herself. So those basic first principles never change. They are first principles, so foundational for any kind of teaching. But that doesn't mean still that they come to, I would say, hasty decisions. They're very careful to get the scientific, the factual aspects right as well. And then that combination of facts and theological principles really come together and end up in a document that is then evaluated by theologians as well, because that's the task of theology, is to you know, sort of make sense of this, if you like. And in many ways to explain it and be able to talk to what I call the people in the pews, just, you know, what's involved here. Sometimes not even so much what the church says, because they'll know that, but why the church says it, which is, you know, the question mark for most people. So, yeah.
That's fantastic. You know, I'm reminded of, as I was looking into the Catholic Church, I was a bit of a debate junkie, and I remember this fantastic debate with Father Mitch Pacwa, who's just an amazing priest, and this Protestant pastor on the idea of sola scriptura. And at the very end of the debate, this Protestant pastor marched or pulled out this giant briefcase on wheels and in a very dramatic fashion opened it and started piling up these giant textbooks onto the table, like thump, thump, thump. And I thought, what is he doing? And then he very dramatically says, "This is all you need to know, the Catholic Church says, to be a proper Christian." And just there's this big pile of books. And he said, "For me, this is all I need." And he holds up the Bible. Yeah. And I thought, whoa, like, you know, he had me for a minute there.
Sure. Yeah.
And then Father Mitch, who's a brilliant man, stands up and he says, "Well, the reason why the church has all that is because new things develop and the church has to speak to new issues."
Yes.
And I thought, oh, you know, and I was like, yeah, you know, what sense that makes. And I thought that was just such a fantastic illustration of what you're talking about here, right?
Well, sure, because, I mean, in vitro fertilization doesn't feature in scripture, you know, or robotization or artificial intelligence, you know, all these things that are conditioning healthcare and in turn dealing really more essentially with human and Christian anthropology. So the world is expanding, our knowledge is expanding, the way we treat the human being, even I think our Christian anthropology is expanding. We have all those questions in sexual ethics, which are, you know, enormously challenging in today's world, that in many respects, again, are not really mentioned except almost incidentally in scripture, because some of those questions just didn't raise any political or social hackles in the same way things were. So you're right. There are more points and different areas. The way even we talk about social justice questions, Catholic social teaching, all these areas in some ways are kind of new-ish. And because most Catholics will say, well, what does the church say in Catholic social teaching? You know, if you want to start talking about Rerum Novarum or one of those encyclicals that are dealing with capitalism and socialism, I mean, in a way it is in scripture, in another way it's not, in the way we've lived through these different regimes. Again, the political developments that simply didn't exist back then. So, I mean, I think the Protestant theologians have a point that so much it can be in some ways captured through scriptural passages, through scriptural application to, you know, current dilemmas. But I don't think they can really be explained or developed unless you go through all these other steps of, you know, like deductive theology, really pushing the debates, really considering all the concomitant factors. So yeah, so I know it's a very different approach, and it's, you know, it's a kind of still a thorny problem with some denominations in the Catholic Church. I do know that, but it just, anyway, to me and to anybody else who accepts this way of doing things, it just seems like a fuller picture, especially for somebody like myself who maybe went into theology because I had so many questions myself. So scripture really, you know, provokes those questions. But you don't really get the answer, a fuller sort of, let's just say, a kind of more rational explanation. I can see it at one level, and at many levels, like the parables, makes perfect sense. You don't have to do a sort of, you know, theological or hermeneutical approach. Jesus was brilliant after all. He just used the simple message and we all kind of saw it. But again, there are so many other areas where most of us need a little bit more, perhaps to convince us, or perhaps to just really sort of see, oh, yes, at that level. You know, so my heart says yes, but now my mind is somehow in league with my heart, and I can, you know. So it's the both and bit that I think is so, to me, is so impressive about the Catholic approach. I mean, I'm biased. I know I'm biased.
Oh, no, that's so well said. And you know what? Something that I have talked to a number of converts about is this idea of when we became Catholic, it's the sense of finally being able to rest in something and know that if we trust the church's authority, we don't have to be the ones to anymore wrestle with all these issues ourselves anymore. We can trust that the church has the authority, if we believe what she says about herself, to wrestle with these things and come to authoritative, guiding principles that the faithful can then use to understand how to approach these things. It's such a different dynamic than having to root out all these things ourselves. It's this sense of resting in the arms of this church, if you will.
Right. Well, that's rather beautiful. And when you're a cradle Catholic, in many ways, you don't have that appreciation. And so, in fact, that very authority is what many cradle Catholics wrestle with. And because I think they see it as authoritarianism, which is so different from what the church is meaning, just that idea that there are so many lines, so many centuries, so much wisdom, so much reflection goes into all these areas that, I can see why so many people really, as you say, can feel they can rest in it. And at least it means, and I'm putting it down at the at least level, you're talking about, a tradition that has weight and has authority by that weight. So, I mean, it has its scriptural warrant as well, for sure. But it also has this, if you like, philosophical / theological warrant as well. There's been a lot of good thinking that goes into it. It still means that we have to enter into that thinking. I mean, some people can rest in it perhaps a bit more easily than others. I think it very much depends on the brain that God has given us, or that quest for something. But I do think it's true that there's a sense that in the Catholic Church, I've always myself felt that once I started thinking, that there is a real quest for truth. So Thomas Aquinas, to me, he's one of my, sort of icons, if you like, to use a modern term, because he always said that, well, if there is this inner drive, if we have a conscience, it's because we really are looking for truth. And only, the truth can set you free and all those other things that are said. But there is just that human sort of search for the truth. We do want to know. We do want to feel certain. And I think that is that's what sort of impels so many people to sort of keep on searching and searching. And then when they find that there is, Aquinas would say, well, truth is reality. You have to deal with reality. You have to be able to sort of take any situation and get down to its basic factual circumstances. And of course, illumined by scripture. But if you're really serious about looking for reality, which you would equate with truth, then, I mean, that's very scientific as well. That's what they're trying to do. So, I mean, it goes right across the board. It's not just the theology. I mean, if you're a humanities scholar and you're, you have these insights, these universal insights, a Shakespeare type thing, where things are said that are almost the same as scripture in a sense, because they capture these universals about the human being. And we see the truth in that because it's real. We see the reality in that. I think all those areas really come together, for us. And so I think there is a sense, especially if you actually pursue it a little bit further and you don't just accept it at the beginning. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I know a lot of people accept many things on faith. And I think that's good. But I think many of us just approach it in a slightly different way. Maybe we need a bit more convincing. Maybe it's a doubting Thomas element. But there's a push when it's truth. You want to extend it as far as possible. You're not going to settle for easy answers. You're not going to settle for the soft option. To me, that's that divine spark that Aquinas also talks about. It's intellectual as well as in your soul. I don't really separate them from that point of view. So to look for truth is a real driving force. And I think that's what's so, to me, that's what's so exciting about theology, is what's so exciting about Catholic teaching, that there is an avenue that you feel is kind of helping you or leading you along that avenue to something that you maybe didn't quite see before. And it's open-ended. I mean, it's not as if any one of us can say we have the truth, but I think we have a real sense of, the via veritas vita, moving along that road to the truth. And, I think other denominations probably deal with that very well as well. I'm really familiar, obviously, with the Catholic approach and the sort of mental, spiritual, psychological, very integrated approach, which I think then really kind of does more justice, perhaps, to the truth of the whole human person. Right? So.
Very well said. Okay, let's look at the beginning of life, if we can, sure. Because as a convert, I've actually had a lot of conversations with other converts. We have a secret society, kind of like a group therapy. And I'm always astonished at how many non-Catholic Christians are attracted to Catholicism because of the church's stance on contraception. It often surprises me, but the numbers are enormous. Yeah. Could you unpack for us how the Catholic Church understands those issues at the very beginning of life, even as far back as the act of procreation itself?
Right. I'm actually surprised that there's that many people because, even within the Catholic Church, there's not a unanimous approach to the whole question of contraception. So I think that the Church is teaching, and I believe this, so it's not just because it's the church teaching, it's because I've kind of tried to integrate it in my husband and I's own life as well. Really, it comes very much back to that idea of the dignity of the human person. So that from the time of conception, then this is a totally new entity in the world, made in God's image, self-propelling, etc., that then develops into being a human person. So in the fullness of being, a human person always sounds a little bit anonymous, a little bit cold. So why does the Catholic Church say that contraception is wrong? It's because I think of an appreciation of life. I think it is, sort of saying, my goodness, I mean, the opportunity to bring somebody into the world who's an image of God cannot be a bad thing. By definition, it's a good thing. Right? So now I'm not looking at the circumstances sometimes in which some, kids are born or conceived rather at that stage. But what the church is saying, even in those situations, even when they are dire circumstances, and they can be, then that has nothing to do with the life that's brought into being, that little life right from the beginning has the same hallmark of being made in God's image as the rest of us. So because the church, the Catholic Church, is so, I think it's very positive about marriage and procreation, and so it always through the centuries, although some forms of contraception had always been available, but not really as a matter of routine, but had always been very sort of open to this idea that if you're, this, that both the sexual act in marriage between a man and a woman, as I have to say these days, once upon a time, and didn't have to elaborate on that. But the whole sort of procreative act in itself is raised to a different level. I mean, that the Catholic Church is possibly the only Christian denomination that talks about marriage as a capital S sacrament, so a full sacrament, which is recognizing marriage as the highest calling for a man and a woman together in their relationship. And therefore, their sort of sexual acts after that are also in that kind of category. And so the procreative act is viewed as a gift from God in itself, And, you know, okay, in natural law, it's because we're designed that way, and the procreative drive at the human level is also very strong. But so that there's that natural law basis for it, of course. But the Catholic Church has, if you like, overlaid it with this idea of this is vocational. This is that the sexual acts in themselves are gifts from God that are really meant for the both for the pleasure of the couple, but also for the transmission of life. And it's that duality, what we've always talked about these days as the procreative and the unitive dimensions of the sexual act, that are tied together in importance, so much so that, as you know, at the Second Vatican Council in Gaudium et Spes, they talk about the linking of these two, as both of them being one as important as the other. So it really, beforehand, there had been some teaching that made it look as if the procreative aspect was slightly higher than the unitive aspect, but it made it look as if it was numerical, that there was a first and a second. But that wasn't actually true. I think it wasn't meant to be like that. It was the way it was discussed. But at the Second Vatican Council, they were able to bring those two parts together. And so we talk about that sort of the unitive and the procreative as you can't separate them because they are equally important. And to go against one or the other is a breach of the covenant that council then explained marriage as a covenant between a man and a woman, which of course included their sexual acts and any children that would be born from it. So I think it's an incredibly positive notion of human life. It just so happened that at the same time as the Second Vatican Council, contraception was really taking off in terms of the pill. It was in the same decade, in the 60s, the famous 60s. And so it did provoke a huge reaction. Many people very concerned about having too many children being seen as, and I'm talking not about people who were necessarily not well off or anything like that. You can see in some circumstances why people might think that they want to limit their family. But there was a kind of not looking at the positives, I think, in Catholic teaching, but a kind of embracing of contraception as a good. So and I think that was accepted in most Christian denominations as well, that contraception is just fine, if you like. But with Humanae Vitae, in 1968, Paul VI sort of said, no, not really. In a very understanding way, he sort of said, no, the Church's constant teaching has been that this act, this sexual act, is really meant. So he's talking natural law here because it isn't really natural law when he says the sexual act is obviously meant to procreate children. And again, with that very positive aspect of procreation being a good thing, which is very scriptural, and, you know, being a result of God's gift of the sexual act in itself. And so I think that teaching for people who do embrace it, who can see the goodness behind it, it makes a lot of sense. And so, but I'm afraid is the wrong word. I think that our current society, just with the changes in society itself, with more about perhaps women being more free, are certainly maybe wanting to develop their careers, or whatever the reasons are, our priorities changed very much, so that I think a lot of us started to think more in terms of what I would like to do. And so the procreative part came as a more secondary concern. And, you know, in some ways, I don't subscribe to that notion myself, because I think I was actually just getting into the procreative side myself in that particular time. So it was a fascinating time to be different and to be working these things out and to be thinking about it and to decide. So my husband and I, for example, that it made more sense for us just to be open to life. I mean, open to life sounded to me like a good thing. But that meant that sort of artificial contraception, as it's called, it is just contraception, it's artificial by definition, then was not something that we would want to follow. And I always sort of felt that you know, life goes on if you're fortunate for a long time. The procreative years are, they're not so incredibly long, weighed against a whole lifetime. But a lot of people don't think long term. The church thinks long term. I think we as humans are more inclined just to think just now, you know, and immediacy. And anyway, we have these two strains, I think. And there are allowances in Catholic teaching for conscientious decision making in this area, which I think is very important, because I wouldn't for 1 minute say that everybody is the same and everybody's circumstances are the same, and that there are sometimes situations where people can make decisions in conscience, so subjective decisions for them. It doesn't take away from the church's objective teaching, which continues to say that contraception is wrong, and that we should at least be open in our sexual acts to the transmission of life. And that sort of positive aspect of sex and sexuality just always made more sense to me and to many people. And as you're suggesting, other people who think about it in a deeper way than, you know, today's world where it's just part of the scenery. You know, this is what you do. You get married and you wait for a while, etc. Actually, it's changed a little bit because people are getting married later, partly because of contraception, right? So, I mean, the whole social sort of scene changed a lot because of what contraception made possible. So it's quite funny to see how it does actually affect, you know, now I see people becoming parents at a much older age than my generation would have. And those are different sort of questions and different problems. And I do wonder, long-term studies eventually will probably show, does it really make us any happier? Are our lives any different because we use contraception? Are those of us who didn't or started to use natural family planning, you know, were we browbeaten or unhappy or whatever? Did we suffer? Absolutely not. But that particular area is a very difficult area these days. That's why I'm really quite happy, actually, to hear you say that there are people who, having looked at it, see the merit or the beauty, perhaps, if you really want to see it like that. I don't want to overplay it. It's a very human dimension. But it does have that gift of God, you know, aspect to it that I just think has to trump any kind of shorter term gain that maybe people do have by making children secondary. Yeah,
that's very well said. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is a related issue, I think. In the age of social media, it seems like any attempt to even discuss the issue of abortion, to try and express a Catholic pro-life point of view, is met with vitriol. I mean, I feel, and I don't think I'm alone in feeling this, but, you know, we've almost lost the ground beneath our feet on which to even hold a conversation about something that I think is a pillar of the Catholic paradigm. Yeah. So I wonder what advice you would give to Catholics who are passionate about the sanctity of life, or even non-Catholic Christians who see the value in defending this.
Yeah.
What advice would you give us for even having these conversations? I mean, how do you even approach that sometimes these days?
Yeah, I agree. It has been very difficult for maybe 30, 40 years to be on the side of life. But I think it's almost parallel to what I said about contraception, even although it's a very different issue and much more serious. But although I didn't get into abortifacients and contraception, which would bring the abortion area into that area too, because many people forget that. But that's yet another area. I think it's the idea that we really do believe that every life is a gift from God, from conception onwards. And that even if, for me, even if people aren't religious, it's, you know, it's the way people used to say it's just a clump of cells, etc. This is many years ago, until the science proved incontrovertible about the development of the embryo and all that sort of thing, you know. And so people couldn't say that anymore, that you could dispose of it because... So then the argument changed to choice, that it was just the woman's choice, and all the argument that still subsists today. So I think for me the only way is always just to be so positive about human life and to talk about the sort of natural, I still think it's a natural trajectory of the man-woman relationship, that this is partly what we're, you know, made for. Physically, it's clear that that's what we're made for. But I mean, deeper than the physical, the whole question of motherhood, fatherhood, I think that question goes much deeper than many people realize until they become parents, and then many people change, you know, because they really see it then. I've seen that time after time. You know, people have their first kid and it's a miracle, and it's, you know, and that's wonderful because it is. And I think they should be reacting like that. So I have not ever seen much value in berating people, or being, I'm not a big fan of showing all the horrible, horrific pictures of abortion. You know, I don't dispute them, they're real, etc. But people don't listen to that. People, they don't want to face up to that aspect. So I guess the idea is to portray in one's own life, and even in, you know, how one lives one's life or how one deals with one's own children, etc. And also being very involved maybe socially and helping in other areas. I mean, I think there's a huge avenue for that. I used to be involved in a crisis pregnancy center myself. I've always been involved, not the past while, but, you know, for most of my adult life in a pro-life group or in a crisis pregnancy center. So something very practical, as well as always just being sort of willing to speak up, even when people are very negative about it. And when it comes to, when the argument shifted to a woman's right to choose, you know, which is still the basic argument, I just think there are so many logical holes in that, you know, because, yeah, a woman does have a right to choose about many things, but nobody has a right to choose, you know, absolutely everything about oneself, and the fact that this is clearly a separate human being. That whole idea, again, of just that control and taking over, etc., is, to me, that's just not logical, quite apart from, you know, not very motherly or perhaps being slightly, if I say self-centered, then I would be accused of being judgmental, but only thinking about myself, that kind of thing, all those ways. So there's so many ways to be positive about life. And it bothers me sometimes that many people don't want to say it like that, though, because there is a backlash very often from society. I'm used to that. I mean, it happens a lot, so you get used to it. And that's not the worst thing in the world. I mean, if I'm a Christian, I have to witness. And so, but I don't mean, I'm not the bulldozing kind of going there and, you know, waste of time, right? That's not the real Christian way. So I think it's a very slow process. What I'm really get a lot of strength from is the fact that, again, the Catholic Church is so consistent in what it says about life and continues. You know, and our present Pope has been very helpful in that idea of extending, you know, that Christian approach right across the spectrum, but never forgets, you know, from conception until natural death. So the whole spectrum. I don't think that answers your question very well, but
no, I think that's fantastic. I mean, what I'm thinking, what basically you have told us is we have to live as a Christian by example in this area, as we would with any area of our faith life, right? In the same way we're supposed to be generous as a Christian and show mercy and grace to people, you're also, you know, you're giving us a practical way of living out this aspect of our Christian faith life.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. We have to be practical as well.
You know, and I do think it's interesting how you talked about how it once the science kind of made it obvious that this was developing life, not just a clump of cells, that then the issue kind of had to be pivoted to a woman's right to choose. Right. I still wonder how, because, I mean, in all the unfruitful conversations that I've tried to have with people, if you bring up that science, it's just as if, you know, a person can be so scientific about everything, you know, God can't exist because science has proved he doesn't exist. But suddenly when you're talking about abortion, that same science holds no weight for them.
Yeah. Well, that's, again, I find there's an illogicality. So just at that level, there's a denial. I think there's a denial, whether it's deliberate or whatever, you know, but it's so much in the culture. It's so much what people think, you know. So a prime minister that doesn't allow people in his caucus unless they subscribe to the pro-choice view. So it's at many different layers, including that very important layer, because it is. So when we're constantly hearing that kind of thing and people not saying anything against it on the whole, just sort of saying, oh, yeah, okay. That always blows my mind, actually, that people can't see that that's a kind of challenge just to their own moral freedom, apart from anything else. But the people denying science, a little anecdote here, I mean, again, decades ago, when they developed ultrasound, and I remember... So an ultrasound, when a woman has an ultrasound now, and if you're pregnant and you see this little one swimming around in the amniotic fluid, and it's kind of beautiful. It is beautiful. It's amazing to watch it of its own volition, just, you know, moving around in the fluid. And I remember thinking, now when people see that, then they'll see this is really a little independent being, you know. But no, people weren't convinced. That didn't matter, you know. When they're pregnant and they go and see the ultrasound, they think it's fantastic, but it doesn't affect the actual argument. So we seem to be weighed down by this kind of denial of personhood. It's like Canadian law, you know, that says you're not a person, meaning you don't have any rights, until you're completely delivered from the birth canal of your mother. It's the only jurisdiction, I think, that actually says that. And the other anomaly is that different jurisdictions, as you know, have different levels of when you become a person, as if there can be different times. But those are all, I'm going to call them man-made, certainly person-made rules to fit the circumstances, so that in Canada, only the woman does have the right then, right through the pregnancy, to decide what's going to happen. Not even the man involved, just the woman. I mean, there's so many areas where it just doesn't make sense at many, many levels, but to maintain this right, which seems to be so important, everything else seems to go by the wayside. I think the only counter to that is that, I'm back to Aquinas here, anything that's not based on reality cannot survive forever. It may take another 100 years. I mean, I don't know. It may take 50. I don't know. None of us knows. But if there is a going against reality, eventually it has to be exploded, because it always works out that way. Yeah.
That's a fantastic way of putting it. Great thought. And I appreciate throwing in some more Aquinas there. So the other end of the spectrum, then, I mean, of course, there's all these issues in the middle of life to deal with, and bioethical, Catholic moral questions. Yeah. But the other end of the spectrum, and this was a major issue in Canada most recently, but many of my listeners are international. So what happens up here in a little backwater country is not always news for them. But physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia, is the other end of the spectrum of life. And how are we to understand the Catholic perspective on these end-of-life issues?
Well, I think it's pretty straightforward. I mean, at that very basic level, if I'm made in God's image, and so this is the Catholic perspective, then I have this incredible dignity derived from God from conception until natural death. And so the whole approach is that while I do have a sort of autonomous individual life. I'm a creature. I'm made. I didn't make myself. I'm not really. I don't have that power of coming into being. And the church is more or less saying I shouldn't have the power to end my life either. So I accept it as something that comes from God. Here you go with Aquinas again, the Exodus and the Reditus, right? The coming from God and the going back to God. It's all within God's sphere. We come into being through our parents, granted, but the whole miraculous sort of way of it's happening, we are seeing as that God-given bringing into life, that is, you know, it's that makes us human. It's that that gives us life. And the same at the other end, that life is such a precious gift, and we talk about being stewards of that life and not owners of it any more than I own my children. I give birth to them, but then they are they, and that's the way it has to be, should be, is, in fact. So the idea that are definitely problems for many people at the end of life, and we cannot sort of avoid dealing with that. So I wouldn't want to sound like Pollyanna about all that. But there is that very deep conviction that we're born to go back to God, and that every day obviously has to die, and there will be many ways of that happening, but that it should be in God's time and not ours, that it should be God's decision and not something that's within our power. I mean, it is technically within our power, of course, but we're talking about the shoulds now and not just a kind of legal decision or anything like that. Quite apart, I think, from the different problems that seem to arise on the euthanasia side, as we're experiencing, you know, once something is allowed, then the next questions that people could see from years back before legalization would happen, that minors would be allowed to ask for it or would be allowed to be euthanized, or people with mental problems or depression would ask to be euthanized, all those kinds of things that we can see coming to pass, that for many people, that's not what they thought euthanasia was about. And that's maybe not what they think should apply. But once we sort of, as usual, open that door, it just seems to multiply and multiply. And then there's the other side. I have to say this, that I think it's maybe a little bit easier when there's a religious part to our makeup, when we really do appreciate what suffering can do, when we do sort of link it, if you like, to the mystery of Christ's suffering. I mean, we are really able. I don't think it makes it any easier for many people. But there is a moral and emotional difference in that kind of viewpoint. And so, but that does not discount either the great strides that have been made in palliative care and pain control. So it's not as if we're saying to people, you must suffer. That is not the Christian approach. It's not a must anything. But our church has been very clear, in fact, that if there is a good pain medication and we want to take it, we should take it. Pius XII, way back in 1952, said that, you know, if you really want to stay conscious and unite your suffering with Christ, and you know, that could be physical or mental or emotional or just the end of life suffering. It doesn't necessarily have to be extremely painful. It's not as if everybody dies a very painful death, which is very reassuring, I think, for people. These days, that pain isn't even, at least in our societies, isn't really necessary because of the control we have, pain control medication. And he said that, you know, as long as you sort of make your reconciliation with your family and have the last rites from the church, then you can take pain medication even to the level of really deep sedation to control the pain. And this is not wanting to die, this is controlling the pain. And he was saying you can do that. It's just, you know, it's within the human ambit to control the pain. There is no need to suffer. If somebody wants to unite their suffering with Christ, and some people are probably able to do that, then they should also be allowed to do that. But he was more or less saying, but you don't have to. This is not a prerequisite. This is not a demand. Very far from it. After all, I really believe theologically Christ already suffered for us, as they say, once and for all. And so, you know, there's a theological side to that, and there's a very human pastoral side too. Again, in the Catholic Church, you always have both, right? The theological and the pastoral at the same time, and they should fit together as much as possible. So I don't think huge demands are made on people to suffer. I think where our churches, all of them, could maybe do a slightly better job is to accompany people. Again, Pope Francis has really brought that word to the fore at the end of life. So that idea of being with, nearly all the statistics say that people, you know, if they ask for assisted suicide, that they're very often lonely or, you know, at the end of their tether. It's not necessarily physical pain. It's really quite amazing all that those different reasons. Or they just don't see any point in living anymore. I mean, that's really sad. And that's kind of depression if you don't see any, you know, there's many areas I think we could be helped. And I think that would be, again, the task of the Catholic Church to sort of say, look, we know this is maybe not going to be, you know, without struggle, but there are ways that you can be helped through this. To me, there's nothing more Christian, again, you know, on the medical side, good palliative care, and on the spiritual, emotional side, you know, counseling, accompaniment, just being with. So many people are doing that. Did you know that in the volunteer sphere, the highest percentage, at least per capita, are people who are volunteering in palliative care? I was really sort of excited to see that figure, because it just means so many people are seeing the value in, you know, doing that for people. And, you know, so at the beginning of life, we have all this help. And at the end of life, we really need that help. Many people, not everybody, but many people need that help as well. So there's areas we could really, you know, sort of encourage a lot more at the same time as trying to deal with the legalities of euthanasia.
Well, that's such a beautiful picture you paint there of how the Catholic Church and how we as Catholics can wrap around people from right from the beginning, where we can help, you know, young mothers bring life into the world and support them and young families. And then at the end of life, the same kind of thing, help those people to accompany them, right, to be walking alongside them. That's such a beautiful picture that you paint.
Well, you know, it just seems to me that that's so much more human to, you know, to react like that. And just to say, okay, here's the needle, you know, and goodbye. That to me just sounds, quite honestly, apart from the morality of it, just at the human level, just kind of cold and clinical and disposing of a problem. And, you know, we as humans, I mean, we are problematic sometimes, but that's not the core of who we are. There's just so many other ways that, I think that's the Christian message. Is, you know, you when we talk about solidarity, which sounds like a political movement, and partly was, but that idea of just being, you know, being there for other people. How much more human can you be? I mean, I think that's a natural thing for us to do, though I think we maybe need all to be a bit more encouraged to do it. But it's giving of yourself to be with other people. And, you know, and as I said, so many people seem to be volunteering to do exactly that. But I think that's very encouraging. So I hope that develops. Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. Okay, I have one more question for you. And it's this. I'm wondering what bioethical issues that you see Catholics having to grapple with in the near term, in the future. I mean, what should Catholics be ready to respond to?
Okay, good questions. Because again, there's quite a few things going on at the minute. In my own Bioethics Institute, we have been dealing a lot with gender issues. So the whole question of gender dysphoria, sexual reassignment surgery, So I'm looking at it more from the bioethical point of view, the medical bioethics point of view, than even the psychological point of view. But, you know, sort of the question of long-term studies, what has been done, what needs to be done, how best to respond, especially to young children who are presenting, because they need, again, counseling accompaniment. I mean, if they're presenting as a problem, then, you know, there needs to be a response. So a lot of Catholic institutes and facilities, etc., are wrestling with that. I just came back from the Czech Republic, and so I was there talking about euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide because that particular country is just about to raise it in their parliament. It isn't legal there, but they're moving towards it. So while Canada is ahead of the pack on that side, is still a very big issue for us, for Catholics, in terms of doctors' consciences and what's allowed, say, in long-term care facilities, that kind of thing. Something else I'm working on, which maybe sounds a little bit futuristic but isn't because it's already here, is the whole question of moral bioenhancement. So the idea of using technology, etc., to actually affect our brains. Sometimes actually by means of a computer chip. Some incredible people who are, actually have a sort of implant in their own brain and connecting with computers. It sounds kind of futuristic, as I said. But the ethical concerns about all that are just questions that are being raised. Artificial intelligence, robotics. So again, more from the whole question of robotization, say of healthcare, you know, about interface with humans. Would you rather talk to a human or a robot? Can they help or are they taking over? It sounds a bit, it's not far-fetched. They're very much in place in some of the hospitals. And just as the first, you know, kind of to navigate the system, just to ask questions where humans are being saved for later on. But there's some really deep ethical questions there, I think, about, you know, again, that our interface with machines and how it's changing us and all those kinds of things as well. So actually, the Vatican has been very involved in that. I'm planning to, they had a conference on a robotization last February. There's one in this, I couldn't go. There's one this February on artificial intelligence that I'm really, I really would like to go, because there are just so many areas. So, I mean, there's this sort of, if you like, there's positive aspects where it could be very useful in healthcare. There is the other side that's a bit more dramatic, kind of out of the sphere of bioethics, but very much in the realm of moral theology, about lethal autonomous weapons and all the just war arguments, debates that go on around that. And of course, those are global then, you know, so the scope can really vary from, you know, a robot in the hospital who's asking a kid or helping a kid ask questions, to lethal autonomous weapons. So those are huge. And I think some of them will only become deeper as time goes on. What else? I'm not sure. I just know there's the whole genetic side, of course, which is really morphing into bigger and bigger ethical questions. And there's a whole area of synthetic biology where you're using, synthetic material in humans, and all those sort of ethical questions that affect people in one level, and in other senses are maybe perhaps more social justice issues, where they affect people's livelihoods, as you know, so artificial vanilla versus real vanilla. Whole areas in some countries in the global south are being affected by not being able to, you know, to just live as they always have in the production of this, because the synthetic stuff is taken over. So it sounds like a big mix, but they very often converge on just the sort of impact on the human person, which to me is kind of bioethics at core. Yeah.
Well, all I know is when the robots come to take over, I'm going to be calling you for some advice.
It's a thought, though, isn't it? Yeah. It's very interesting, though. I mean, I must say it's fascinating. It really is. I mean, there are clear dangers, but there are benefits as well. And so to sort of sort all those out and not just be too, thinking like it's something in a movie or anything, yeah, it's going to be interesting. It's a very, as usual, it's very interesting times we live in.
That's fantastic. Well, I want to really, truly thank you for being on the podcast. This has been a fantastic discussion. I've really enjoyed it. I think you are going to teach all the listeners at least one new thing, if not very, very many new things. So thank you very much. And where can people go to find out more information about what you're doing, the Institute, things maybe you've written or that kind of stuff?
Oh, thank you. So it's called, big long name, Canadian Catholic Bioethics Institute. So if you Google that, you find it. And our website, I think, is ccbi-utoronto.ca. And so on that website, that's where we've, myself and my colleagues have, we've written fairly short, they're not newsletters, really short teachings. We call them Bioethics Matters. And we've covered a lot of different areas over the past 14 or 15 years, and sort of, you know, changing. Some of them are more are newish concerns, and others are the ones that are ongoing. I mean, we're still always getting phone calls about artificial nutrition and hydration, and when can somebody come off life support. I mean, all those very basic, really important questions for people when they're in crisis situations. You know, and we have other documentation about palliative care, and they all revolve around the teaching of the Catholic Church. And so we in a way, we're really trying to help the Catholic bishops in Canada by sort of developing some of these areas that they use our material as well, and just in terms of basic information. And when something new comes along, then, you know, to try and get something going on it. So yeah, that's the bottom line.
Well, fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much again for being here. I appreciate your time. God bless you and your family and the fantastic work you're doing for the church.
Oh, thank you, Keith. I'm delighted to have done this. I told you I'm quite happy to talk if somebody asks me the questions. It's great what you're doing. I think it sounds like you have an international audience, which is wonderful in itself, and it's a real ministry what you are doing. So I really appreciate that, and thanks very much for having me as a guest.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Cordial Catholic Podcast. I hope you enjoyed that discussion. I think it was a fantastic one, and I'm sure you learned something new. Please visit our website at thecordialcatholic.com for links and show notes. I'm on Twitter at Cordial Catholic, on Facebook at The Cordial Catholic, and send your emails, complaints, criticisms, or even encouragements to cordialcatholic@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and it helps me to continue to grow and build and improve this show. Please subscribe to or follow this show wherever you find it. Please leave ratings and reviews. Those especially help to push this podcast out to new people. And hey, if you want to support this show financially, you can do that at patreon.com/cordialcatholic. Honestly, guys, even $1 or $2 a month, even the price of a cup of coffee every month, would help this show to continue to grow. It would help me not to have to worry about finances and keep this show sustainable. I really appreciate those already supporting the show so much. It's at patreon.com/cordialcatholic. Anyone that supports the show gets access to a special behind-the-scenes show released at least every month. Often more than that, and $8 or more a month gets you a copy of Jimmy Akin's new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. Please pray for me. Please know that you are in my prayers as well. Thank you so much for listening to this show. Take care, see you next week, and God bless. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcafe. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.